Greetings, cool kids. Welcome to the first in a small series of what I'm going to call the Alt-Ack podcasts. If you're listening to this, I am Dr. Julia Daniel from the English department at Baylor. I am phrasing it that way because I'm kind of creating this for an in-house audience, but I am very aware that once one makes a digital object, there is no telling where it might fly in the universe. So if you are listening to this, I am assuming that you are someone who is working on a PhD in some field of the humanities, or maybe you're working on an MA and you're trying to think through, you know, should I go for the PhD? Is it worth it? The answer to that question is it depends. And I'm assuming that you guys are at all different kinds of stages, right? Maybe if there's interest at another point in time, I can do something really tightly tailored to those of you actively on the job market. But right now, this is just a kind of like broad discussion about what does the academic job market look like? What does that mean for you envisioning your best, most beautiful, radiant, flourishing life? Because guys, I am going to talk about a lot of not great stuff. Like, there's a lot of bleak. And I'm going to kind of foreground the bleak. But the goal here is for each and every one of you to lead a life where you feel nourished and where you flourish. To lead a life where you are taking care of yourself. You feel comfortable taking care of the people you care about, and that ideally you enjoy what it is that you do. This is the name of the game. So anticipate that this is going to be, you know, there's going to be some like nitty gritty crunchy details in here, but I'm going to go to church a little bit. So I'm just going to tell you to brace for that, because what we're really talking about is discerning your vocation. And discerning your vocation can be really hard when you're in a place where you're like, I thought I had already done that, Julia. I had discerned my vocation and I want to be an English professor. And Julia is here to tell you that that job functionally sort of doesn't exist anymore. So more on that in a minute. I feel like I'm calling this a podcast. It's me sitting alone in a room, drinking a cup of tea, talking at a computer. I feel like I should have had like intro music, like welcome to the Alt-Ack conversation. So in this episode, I want to talk about the state of the job market. If you're like, lady, I don't need to hear it. I already know it's garbage. My heart is already broken. I am ready to like move on and talk about what do I do now? Awesome. Don't listen to this one. I am going to the next podcast that I make is going to be specifically about how do you do a reassessment? So if you are going to start actively working towards non-ivory tower jobs, how do you start imagining that? But I am in this isn't all just doom and gloom, guys. In this session, I'm going to be talking about the state of the job market, but I'm also going to be talking a little bit about like, if you are one of the lucky 2%, that is correct, 2% of job candidates who lands a tenure track job, what does that actually look like? And maybe it's not the job that you want once I tell you what it looks like. It's a weird fact that being in graduate school in many ways doesn't give you a great vision of what the actual labor of the academic professor is and what it looks like. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I will give away my thesis right here at the beginning. And my thesis is this: getting an academic job should be your plan B. Your plan A should be to land a wonderful, fun, good-paying, field-adjacent job. So the good news here is I'm not saying you got to give it up forever. That are people like, is somebody somewhere still going to hire a historian or a modernist? Sure. Yeah. I think so. I hope so. More on that in a little bit. You can still absolutely be working toward that, but it should absolutely not be your first go-to in terms of imagining a job. And then the question becomes, yikes, Julia, it sounds like you're telling me then that I'm kind of like actively training myself and developing my portfolio for two different jobs at the same time, or three or four. And the answer to that is, yep, that is what I am telling you to do. Let's talk a little bit about the academic job market, shall we? If you're here, you already know that it's bad. We've been saying that the job market is bad since the dawn of time. But every year, the statement becomes increasingly truer. A little bit about my experience. So, oh God, I went to grad school a long time ago. I just thought out loud to myself. So I did an undergraduate. I got my BA. I did a two-year gap year where I was teaching humanities classes in a women's homeless shelter. It was awesome. I loved it. Then I got my MA, PhD combined at Loyola University. Took me 6 years. Then I had a postdoc. So I did the job market that year, got nothing, but landed the postdoc at Loyola. I had the postdoc at Loyola for a year, did the job market again, landed a job at West Virginia University. Worked at West Virginia University for 2 years, realized that my salary was literally not going to be enough to feed my family. Again, this might not be the job that you want. Did the job market again, and then landed my amazing job here at Baylor. And I've been here for 6 years. So I've done the job market 3 times. That's the second time I did it. I also did it pregnant. So if anybody's interested in hearing about that, I've got lots of thoughts about what that experience is like. And then I've been working with PhD students and candidates ever since on their own job searches. So that's kind of the experience that I am bringing with me. I'm also just personally sort of interested in thinking through what does a PhD path of study look like if we're trying to reimagine it so that our students can pivot and be more versatile. And I'm sorry I'm using the word pivot so much. I know that that sounds super corporate, but in my mind, I really am thinking of a dancer. You're waltzing. You're improvising, you are tangoing through this process. If I could recommend some books that have sort of influenced my thinking on this stuff, the first one that I would recommend is Leaving Academia by Christopher Catterine. It is, man, it's some tough medicine. So it is a unflinching look at the state of higher education and the job market. Catterine has a PhD in classics from UVA and worked at Tulane for a while before leaving for a corporate gig, and writes a lot about that process. And the book is fairly recent. It came out in 2020. So I like it too because it's very current. I also really like Going Alt-Ac, A Guide to Alternative Academic Careers by Catherine Linder. That I feel like is written in a slightly friendlier tone, and so in some ways is easier to consume. But I think both of these are great places to start. If you guys know the website The Professor Is In, I love The Professor Is In. The Professor Is In has lots of great advice for doing the academic job market, but also has pretty good blog posts on thinking through life outside of higher ed. So I will also say I took The Professor Is In, I took her advice to a T when I did the job market, when I landed my Baylor position, and I would highly recommend it to anybody out there. All right. Let's talk about how bad it is. Are you ready? Here, let's all stop and take a sip of our tea. I'm gonna take a sip of my tea first, okay. All right, when I went on the job market a million years ago, 12 years ago, about a decade ago, everybody was already bemoaning the state of the job market. And maybe this is you, because this was me. I went into my PhD not really having a great sense of the fact that I was entering into a job market. I felt like I was entering into a field of research, that I was a teacher, that I love teaching, that I was an academic, I was joining a conversation. I had zero sense of what that looked like in terms of getting work, but I had been in college and my professors had jobs, and I know that there were colleges in other places in the world, so, you know, there must be work out there. So I kind of went into it pretty blind. I was very fortunate to go to, I did my PhD at Loyola University, and they did a ton of sort of academic job training for us. So pretty quickly, I learned that the job market was very bad. And by the end of my time at Loyola, I had been working teaching English, ELL, English for a community of largely Somali refugees in my neighborhood in Chicago. And so I had been thinking about, I also had some editorial experience. I was like, maybe I could go into publishing. Maybe I could teach high school. Maybe I want to get a certification and teach ELL. But I landed the postdoc. So, but I was already thinking in terms of like, ooh, yikes, I might need to make some decisions here at some point that are not being an English professor. But I came into that sort of late. I also had the benefit of my partner had a job. So my husband and I got married when I was in graduate school. And he was teaching at a Catholic high school in the area. And between that and my postdoc, you know, we were paying our bills. You know, we weren't living high on the hog, but we were totally covering our bills. So I was also fortunate in that respect that I didn't feel like the extraordinary urgency of, oh my gosh, I might not be able to eat in 3 months. And plenty of people find themselves in that position, my friends, unfortunately. That was like a decade ago. When Catherine's book came out in 2020, Catherine's pulling from sort of new updated data on the job market in general, about, and this is speaking for humanities broadly, and English in some ways does a little bit better than the other fields of the humanities because we tend to teach writing and universities still need people to teach writing. But Catherine's research says that only about 4% of people who go on the job market with a PhD in the humanities are going to land full-time work with benefits. That is 4%. And I will tell you that in the world of COVID, I think we can easily assume that that percentage is down to 1. And you're thinking like, oh, but like, you know, but maybe the rest of them are dumb. Like maybe I'm really good and the rest of them like are kind of not great, right? Like this is the hope. We retain the sense of a meritocracy. I can tell you as somebody who's been on hiring committees, you know, 50% of the people out there are easily in the exceptional category. Landing that job in that top 1% in some ways is a marker of your excellence because you have to be really good to be there, but at the same time isn't, because there are thousands upon thousands of brilliant, talented scholars who have done amazing projects that are languishing jobless right now. That number isn't about you. It isn't about how hard you've worked. Which I say, I hope to give you some solace in this. It's about a job market. If you're interested in why these numbers are as they are, here is just like the world's shortest, briefest, gappiest story for it. back in the day when the GI Bill was introduced, especially in the States, there's a huge boom in the public going to college. So, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, the college-going population skyrocketed and universities expanded to meet need. Pretty quickly, however, as we get into, like, the 90s, the aughts, and here we are into the second decade of the 2000s, insert footnote here again, feeling old, there's a kind of contraction that is happening in the humanities in particular, in that most undergraduate students are now realizing, like, it is very expensive to go to college. The cost of college has absolutely skyrocketed for them. And increasingly, the college degree is, it's a ticket for a job. And unless you can sell mom and dad on how this degree is a ticket for a job, why are you going into this debt? Or why are mom and dad shelling this out, right? So we see colleges and universities expanding programs that are specifically targeted to work, like, you know, business schools absolutely explode, for example. Now, at the same time, though, there's this lag. So, like, PhD programs are still motoring along, producing volumes of PhD students on a market that was for a market, you know, a decade ago or two decades ago. And think about that, too. Have mercy on us, your professors. You know, our memory of the market is when we went on the market. In many ways, your PhD advisors train you the way they were trained by people who were even farther away from the current market. And you really need to make a big effort to be interested in the sort of job landscape for PhDs as a professor in order to keep up what's going on. So people are cranking out these PhDs, and slowly, we have fewer and fewer English majors, so we need fewer and fewer people to fill those spots. Correspondingly, universities are also like, hey, why am I spending all this money hiring tenure-track positions? I can totally exploit adjunct labor, pay them like $2,000 a class, get their labor on the cheap, and not have to pay benefits. It's an absolutely horrific and exploitative process. There are every year in the Chronicle, in Inside Higher Ed, there are articles written about, like, adjuncts who have been working at three different institutions living in their cars because they can't pay rent, or dying alone in their studio apartments because they couldn't afford insulin. So let me again say, like, this is real stuff, guys. And it's incredibly tragic. And one of the reasons that universities can do this is, again, there's a glut of qualified PhDs. So they can be super duper picky about who they want for their increasingly dwindling tenure track positions, and take advantage of this glutted market where there's all these frantic PhDs running around just, like, trying to pay the bills, right? Let's add to this the fact that there's a declining birth rate, and man, it's only going to get worse. So starting now-ish, people just aren't having a lot of babies anymore, you guys. So 20 years ago, because of the dip in the birth rate, that has consequences for universities. There's less of a college-going public now. And, like, right now in this moment, I don't know if you guys have seen this. This is so interesting to me. During COVID, everybody assumed, like, people are going to be home. They'll get cozy. There'll probably be a baby bump. Nope. I think being stuck at home with each other made people want to be in separate rooms even more. Or they lost their jobs and were like, I can't shoulder the cost of another child. So there's in this year alone, a dramatic drop in the birth rate. Cast that ahead 20 years. That's when you, hypothetically, would be working at a university. Y'all ain't got no students. I mean, they're just not going to be there. So that's some of the reasons why the market is as bad as it is. Now let's fast forward to right now and then place ourselves in the middle of a historic pandemic. I don't need to tell you guys how horrific it's been, and I probably don't need to tell you how bad it's been for the job market. Lots of universities have put blocks on hiring, where they've said, we're not hiring any new people for at least 5 years. We got to sort out our finances. I mean, we're worried about keeping the lights on. So, one, no jobs, just like everything's on ice for a while here. Two, a whole bunch of little colleges closed. And that was already happening, team. Like, already, small Christian liberal arts universities, the kinds of places we tend to find spots for Baylor students, they actually had started shuttering before COVID, and the pandemic really just accelerated this process. But not just those kinds of institutions. You're even hearing stories now about like big state institutions that are, breaking faith with tenure contracts and just firing people. So when you go on the job market, like let's imagine pretendsies there was a job market this year. Functionally, there's not. You are going on the job market, not only competing with every single other PhD that's graduating this year, you're also going on the market against every other PhD in the last 5 to 10 years who didn't get a job and haven't abandoned the job market yet. You are now also, let's add more to that pile, going on the market against people who had tenure track jobs, who've published books, who've been teaching for years and are now freaking out trying to find a job for themselves. Which is actually one reason why I highly recommend not even bothering trying the academic job market until you have the PhD in hand. I can talk about that a little bit more, but the maybe if you guys are interested, this is another thing, like email Becca. Like, what do you want me to talk about? I will talk about things. Poor Becca. Becca, I'm so sorry if this swamps your inbox. I mean, I guess email me. Why do you have to email Becca? Email me and let me know what you'd like to hear more about. But basically, if you submit an application before you have your PhD in hand, they're not even going to look at it, honey. That goes right into the shredder, the digital shredder. Because why would they? They're getting, 250 applications for a single position. They are looking for a way to trim their pile, and the easiest way to trim the pile is to just be like, well, do you have a PhD? Boomsies. You're out of the pile. The next easiest way to trim your pile, by the way, is have they published? Oh, I know, I know. Maybe I can talk about that another day too. So this is why I say that I think you can easily assume that the job market prospects now are should be closer to 1%, that there is a 1% chance of getting a job. And the reality is even worse, right? Because in the humanities, we're very specialized. So, I am here because Fortuna spun her wheel, and it so happened the year that I looked on the job market, Baylor was looking for somebody who did modernism, American literature, poetry, and drama. That's me, babes. I'm like, yes, thank you. Thank you, Providence. Thank you. So you can look at a job market and be like, well, look, there were like, look at these. Oh, here's 16 positions in theology, but we're specifically looking for somebody who does liberation theology with a focus on South American contexts. That's not you, right? So that kind of specialization makes it even harder for us. The job market by the numbers isn't really your job market. If we're looking at an English job market, but you're a Victorianist who specializes in feminist readings and material culture, maybe 150 jobs goes down to two. Maybe goes down to two. So, yowzer, that's not great. Holy cannoli, Julia, I knew it was bad, but oh, ouch, it's like really, really exceptionally bad. And that is absolutely true. Receiving a PhD in the humanities is absolutely not receiving a promise of a job. Receiving a PhD in the humanities is a mark of your excellence as a scholar. It is an accomplishment unto itself, one that you should be enormously proud of. But you will be setting yourself up for heartbreak if you think that that piece of paper has anything to do with getting a job. Now, let me talk a little bit too about if you did, let's say you won the lotto and you got the job, right? You got the job. Ha! Let's talk a little bit too about why that might not be the great thing that you think it is. I want to say that I am deeply aware that I am talking from a place of ridiculous privilege. It's like, Julia, how can you be saying this? Like, here you are sitting in your fancy office with your tweed coat and your patches on your elbows because you read books so hard that you tear holes through your elbow spot on your jacket. No, I'm sitting in the back room at my house and I'm wearing yoga pants because it's COVID. But in many ways, talking to any professor right now is kind of like talking to a dodo. Now, people have talked to different people. You find me in, you know, it's a gray Tuesday. I'm in one of my more nihilistic moods. In general, you go into a program, you interact with professors, and it's like, well, she's got that job. Like, that's a thing, right? It's kind of not a thing anymore. I work and teach every day with this acute awareness that, like, I might be in the company of one of the last real generations of stable humanities professors. Let me tell you a little bit what I mean by that. One of the things that also crunched the job market is that with a kind of like general devaluing of the humanities as colleges appeal more to kind of marketable degrees for students, in response to student demand, you'll see this increasingly, this sort of like conglomeration of humanities departments. So, you know, the day where we have like an English department, history department, philosophy department, classics department as distinct houses, that day, I think, is swiftly going to be receding into our rearview mirror. Universities are restructuring these into a humanities department. And the reason that they can do that is your tenure. So tenure is job protection, right? Like it's one of the reasons this job is so appealing. It's like you go through 6 years of hazing, and if you pass it and you publish your book and your articles and everybody's happy with you, you have a job forever. No, you don't, guys. Most tenure contracts state that you can be terminated for cause. So like, you know, if you punch a student in the face, don't do that. But also for restructuring. So lots of universities restructured humanities departments into one department as a way to fire a whole bunch of faculty. And all of a sudden, you are one English professor teaching all the English classes for your entire university. And you wake up every day and you think, Jesus, you have a job because six of your colleagues got fired in the reorganization. I think that that is increasingly the kind of thing that is going to be happening as we move into this brave new world of the post-COVID university. So that's number one. Number two is, what is the work actually like? And let me add too, plenty of people also got fired during COVID when they thought that their, you know, status was safe at their universities. And we're learning increasingly it's not as stable as you think it is. So it is absolutely possible to go through this whole ridiculous Baroque process, finally think that you've got some modicum of job security, and end up out the door. Some of the best advice, professional advice I've ever received is always be marketable. So I am so lucky. I'm at an incredibly affluent university that's immensely stable. I have tenure. And let me tell you, I am constantly thinking about and making sure that I could get a job outside of academia if I needed to. So if I'm thinking that, let me tell you, there's lots of people in academia right now who are also like, you know, I want a job at Amazon. I'm getting out of here. Okay, the job itself might also not be what you think it is. The pay varies greatly. And this is the thing we don't talk about, right? Like as Americans, we tend not to talk about money. As academics, this is kind of like the base substance of everyday reality that we don't want to talk about. In many ways, also, the professorate is, we kind of are class passing, right? We're people who have, like, really good taste. You know, we like the nice things. But if you look at our paycheck, I guarantee you that a master electrician is making double what most English professors are making. Easily. A personal story. So when I worked at West Virginia University, my starting salary was $52,000. I was able to make a little bit more money by picking up summer work, teaching summer classes as I could, as they were available. Like the bulk of institutions, especially right now, they were also on a raise freeze. So we didn't get an increase of living raise every year, let alone a performance raise. In most places, it's like, oh, you published a book this year? Maybe I'll give you like a 2% raise. I mean, that's how it used to be, right? So I'm living in this beautiful little mountain town with our little baby, John, a baby at the time, who had some health issues, and my husband, who has a theology degree, and there's like no Catholic schools in West Virginia, like in our little mountain town. And also, even if he had work, we couldn't have afforded childcare for little John. So Spencer stayed at home, I worked, and then in the evenings, Spencer got trained in doing tax prep. He was like, you know, trying to do odd things on the side. Within a year, we realized that even in a relatively affordable town like Morgantown, we know how to live on beans and rice. You know, we try not to live larger than our paycheck, but because of health issues and how expensive food is up in the mountains, everything needs to be trucked up. We were like, we can't do this. Like, this is not doable. And we wanted to have another baby, and we literally couldn't afford saving up to pay the money having a baby in a hospital would cost, let alone more diapers. You know, I was very fortunate I was able to nurse John, but I remember sitting in my office in Morgantown, hooked up to a breast pump, awash with anxiety because I wasn't producing enough milk and we couldn't afford formula. That's when I was like, I'm doing the job market again. Like, we can't do this. I went to my department chair and I said, what do I need to do to get a raise? And he said, you need to do the job market and come at us with a different offer. And then you can negotiate with us. And fortunately, I got an offer from Baylor that was so handsome that WVU was like, we can't compete with that. Bye. It's been fun knowing you. I am immensely lucky right now to live as comfortably as I do. If you manage to be in that 1% that lands a job, you can expect to be teaching a 4-4 load, a pretty heavy service obligation to your department. And man, if you're clearing 55 your first year, you are winning. And if that sounds to you a little ridiculous, yep, sure is. Especially if you think about some of the places that have lots of universities are big cities, which are great because they're cool places to live. And there's like lots of cultural amenities and it's amazing. I'm from Chicago. Love it. Love Chicago. But those are expensive places to live. And even being in an expensive place to live, there's not a lot of wiggle in salary. Why? Because remember, if you don't want that junk salary, somebody else will. Because there's 300 other people applying for the same position. if you are a human who, needs shelter and food and transportation, and medical care, it is totally reasonable and fair and just and prudent to stop and ask yourself, am I willing to do that? Can I live on $47,000 a year out in a field in Ohio next to a university? And that's another thing to think about too, guys, is portability. If you want to land that 1% chance of getting a job, you absolutely have to be willing to move. Absolutely non-negotiable. I never thought I'd be living in Texas, y'all. I'm just going to tell you right now. Unfortunately, I love it. As you can tell, I said y'all, so I've sort of naturalized, but never would have been my first choice, nor would have been living in Morgantown, West Virginia. I knew I had to be able to move. In some ways, I've explained to my mother-in-law, this profession is kind of like living in the working in the military. Like, you go where you're stationed. And that's that. So if you're like, Julia, my mother has a lot of health issues. I need to stick close. I need to be in the Austin metro area. This is not a profession for you. Julia, I have, autoimmune issues that are really exacerbated by the cold. I don't think I can work anywhere above the Mason-Dixon line without being in incredible pain. I don't want that for you. As I said, I want you to flourish. I don't think this job is for you because you really need to be willing to be like, yep, I'm gonna live in Bozeman, Montana, which also I hear is a cute place. Maybe you're like, okay, now if you're like, hey, I can do it. Like, I am mobile. If you're somebody who has a partner, can your partner do it? How far are you willing to be away from family? How much so, if you are planning on starting a family or if you have a family, what about schools? These are all things that impact your mobility for the job market. And it is okay to say no. So this is the good news, guys. There is a huge stigma in, I feel like this was my experience. Hopefully, this is not your experience, but this was my experience as a grad student. I was embarrassed to talk to anyone about the fact that I was thinking of getting out of the game. I certainly didn't want to talk about it to my dissertation director. Lord of mercy, what would David have said? I don't know. I felt shame about it. Feel no shame. Feel no shame. You are a radiant, sentient pillar of stardust with this one gorgeous life gifted to you, and your priority needs to be thinking about, so what are you doing with it? How can you be happy, healthy, and living your vocation in the world? And whatever the answer to that question is, you should feel very comfortable boldly and fully thinking through the answers to that question. Not only do I think you should feel absolutely no shame in exploring non-academic options for your job search, you have to. If you want to roll the dice at the end of this process, I mean, you have better statistical chances rolling a six-sided die than you would in this 1 in 100 shot. I'm gonna kind of wrap up here, and all the really great, awesome, feel-good stuff is gonna be on the next podcast. So please hang in there with me. But I want you to end hearing this, which is there are so many incredibly cool, wonderful, meaningful ways for you to be moving through the world, providing for yourself and the people you care about in a way that is sustainable and nourishing and life-giving. And if you free yourself up to start imagining some of that, it can actually be really exciting. I also want to say that it's okay to give yourself a little bit of room to mourn. Because if you're like in a PhD program right now, I know you got into it because you wanted the jacket with the patches on the elbows. Because at some point in your life, you had a really wonderful experience of being taught by someone like that. You're really energized about debates in your particular field. You're a writer, you're an educator, you care about higher education. And this has been the dream. You need to take a chance and make yourself have a moment and let yourself be sad and mourn for the fact that that is kind of not a thing anymore. And the sooner that you can grieve about it and feel mad about it and like walk through that storm of loss, because it is like, it's a real sense of loss, guys. It really truly is. The sooner that you can do that, the more you'll be on the other side of it and can kind of take a breath, wash your face, take a breath, stretch out, and really begin your new discernment process. Now, as I said before, I don't think that that new discernment process means entirely giving up on the hope of academia. And I'm going to talk more about the kind of technical ways you can do that in my next podcast. If you stuck in there through all of this, my gosh, you're an absolute rock star. I say thank you. I hope, please, please, please listen to the next one. Yes. Okay. All right. I will catch you on the flip side.